The epistle reading today comes from 1 Peter chapter 3, just a wee little passage. It's printed in your bulletin. It says, "Always be ready to make your defense to anyone who demands from you an accounting for the hope that is in you. Yet do it with gentleness and reverence. Keep your conscience clear so that when you are maligned, those who abuse you for your good conduct in Christ may be put to shame. For it is better to suffer for doing good, if suffering should be God's will, than to suffer for doing evil. For Christ also suffered for his sins, once and for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, in order to bring you to God." And this is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. My first year out of seminary, I've talked about this a time or two. I was church planting on the east end of Atlanta. And so we had nothing to start out with. Nothing, no one, no core group, no place to meet, nothing. It was me and Gigi. That was our church. So my job, and she sort of got roped into it, was to go around, try to meet people, and see if we could start a church just from people that we met. So I went all over the place. I had no clue what I was doing. So I would go to coffee shops and hang out, and I'd go and walk my dog and try to run into the same people and make up conversations, and everyone's like, "Why are you talking to me with your dog?" I'd go to restaurants and the local pub, and we'd eat chicken wings and try to talk to strangers. It was a weird time. That was my job. It was a weird time in life. And so I remember one time being someplace eating chicken wings, and I was talking to this lady, and she was a little bit older than me, middle age, 40s or 50s, somewhere in there. And we were talking and having a conversation. I told her about what I was doing, that I was trying to start a church for people who didn't necessarily like church. And she was intrigued by this, but not ready to start in on forming a group. I got that answer quite a bit. But we talked anyway. We had a very open conversation about life and God and faith. And I find that a lot of people are actually willing to have those kinds of conversations. And through it, I remember her answer very clearly. We were talking about these things. And she said, "Well, yeah, I believe in like this force or this energy or this will that means all things for good and that is working everybody towards a beneficial conclusion." She said, "Some people would call that God." And she said, "I call it the universe." And I was struck. I didn't know how to respond to that. I've heard that term quite a bit since then, the universe, as this conscious force, and maybe you have too. I've heard people say it's a sign from the universe, or the universe is trying to tell us something, or the universe is bringing us together, or the universe is sending us apart, of course. It's a wild time in the history of humankind. We live at a unique junction, almost, where being spiritual, a spiritual person, is seen as a very positive thing. You're open-minded, you're enlightened. But if you're a religious person, if you would identify as a religious person, well, then you might be a cult leader or a fanatic of some sort. Spiritual, good. Religious, not so good. We live in a time where, because of our increasing connectivity, we are swapping bits of culture back and forth, and along with that is philosophy and theology. And so in social studies class, our children learn about the five pillars of Islam, or the four noble truths from Buddhism, just as often as they learn about the Ten Commandments or even the teachings of Jesus. It would not be uncommon, and I bet you have talked to someone who said, "I don't dig labels, but I sort of identify myself as a Taoist Presbyterian with Buddhist practices." And people would say, "Oh, they're very spiritual." They are very spiritual. Our knowledge is expanding. Some of you in this very room are responsible for growing the breadth of our scientific capabilities. We have access to so much information now. It's at our fingertips. And I know the day is coming, and it's not very far off, and my kids will come home and say, "Dad, can you help me with my homework?" And I will say, "Probably not, because I won't know what you're talking about." All of that, by the way, I think is to the good. I think it's a good thing that we have access to knowledge and we're expanding our capabilities and technology and all sorts of other things. And I think it's good to learn about other cultures and other faiths and to have a respect and a dialogue about those things. But one of the downsides to that openness, to this wealth of information, is a culture of the new, that we're constantly seeking something new. And that's the culture of Acts 17. Pastors and scholars for a long time have been comparing our modern day culture to that of Athens in the first century. Athens is us. Rome may have been the political authority, that may be where Caesar lives, but the cultural cornerstone of the entire known world was in Athens. They controlled the language. They still spoke Greek. They were responsible for all of the major schools of thought, of art, of religious practice. This Athens was the home of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, and the Parthenon was there with gods from all over the known world, and they put them all in the same place. They didn't have a problem with that. In fact, they prided themselves on that, that they were open-minded enough to incorporate other people's philosophies and thoughts and even gods into their own pantheon. And they would say, bring it on, as long as it's new, as long as we haven't heard it before. Yeah, bring us your ideas. We'd love to hear them. So Paul shows up in Athens and he wants to speak Jesus to them. He wants to give them that idea. And long before this speech that I read up there, he has been out in the marketplace arguing with the people there. He's been debating the Stoics and the Epicureans, who were different philosophical schools in that day. He was in the synagogues in and around Athens, and he was talking and reading scriptures and questioning and doing what Jews love to do in the synagogues. And eventually he gets a reputation enough to where they invite him up to the big leagues. Okay, buddy, we hear about you. We hear you've got some new stuff to share. Why don't you come on up to Mars Hill? Because that's where we all gather to hear the new ideas. So this is your shot. Give it your best. Just don't tell us something that we've heard before. And so he goes up there, goes up to Mars Hill, and he says, Athenians, I've seen all your religious stuff around. You got statues of Zeus and Athena and Poseidon, and you've got all these great things. In fact, this very hill that we're on is called the hill of the war god Ares. So I see that you're a very, very religious people. But you know what I noticed is that as I was walking around, I found an altar that had an inscription on it that says, to an unknown god. He says, I know who that is, and I'd like to share that with you. And you could almost hear in the scripture the people leaning in, oh yeah, what do you got? That's why they're here. They want to hear something new. And so he presents this argument, and it's a beautiful progression of an argument. I found 7 points in it, which I'll read to you. And if you're the kind who likes lists, Paul's your guy. He's got lists everywhere. And it progresses logically and systematically all the way to the resurrection. So the first point is God is the uncreated creator. God makes and sustains life. Humans don't make God. God makes everything else. Number two, God is the Lord over history. Nations rise and fall only because of God's hand. Number three, God is the object of your search. People grope and they feel around and they want to know, and they feel like they can't quite get their hands around it. God is at once transcendent, beyond our grasp, a mystery, and imminent. God is all around us and with us, and in him we move and live and have our being. Number four, God is our Father. You are a child of this God that I am speaking about. Number five, God forgives us. He is willing to look past your ignorance if you would turn to God. And you better, because number six, God is a judge. And at some point in human history, it will all come to a close, and the one whom he has appointed will judge you. And you can know that all of these things are true because number seven, God raised Jesus from the dead. And that is the proof of all these things. The response to that was what you would expect from a bunch of intellectuals and scholars on a literal ivory tower on a hilltop. The intellectuals scoffed at him and they laughed. And a few of the others said, you know what, that's an interesting idea. I think I'd like to hear it again. And just a bare few of them said, yeah, I'll join up. And they became believers that day. By the way, if you're a list kind of person, I do have those in my pocket. Ask me afterward and I'll get it to you. You don't have to break your hand writing them down. I want to pause here for just a moment and let that sink in. Paul is the greatest, probably of human history, evangelist of the gospel. He is single-handedly responsible for planting more churches than we know about. All over Asia and into Europe and parts of Africa, Paul is spreading the good news of Jesus Christ. He was more gifted at it than maybe anyone else in human history. He was so good at it that when he was put in prison, he converted his own jailer to his faith. That's charisma. But you notice this here? His batting average is pretty low. Most people are laughing at him and treating him as some sort of novelty, a nice, foolish, mad little distraction. So we shouldn't get all that upset if our efforts don't go so well either. We've been speaking these past few weeks about being holy fools. And what I mean by that is what we are up to here in church is foolishness by the logic of the world. And it is. The gospel is sort of like this cosmic joke that death, turns out, doesn't work so well. What we once thought was unbeatable is turned upside down and the whole world with it. The church is full of these people, these backward-style people who live this upside-down way of the gospel. They give of themselves and they sacrifice their own time, their own money, their own well-being, so that others might be reached and saved. And in fact, they love their own enemies, the people who hate them. They love them. Could you imagine such foolish madmen as these? They even treat persecution as a positive sign, because it means the gospel will continue to spread. And that's what we were talking about last week. It's foolishness. It's madness. And we are those holy fools who keep it going. That's us. And that is just what we're called to be. Paul was a fool on top of that hill. And we are called to join in and be fools with him. The passage that I read from Peter says, Peter is exhorting the disciples, and he says, always be ready to give an account, a defense, a reason, a testimony for the hope that is within you. In other words, he's saying, always be ready to tell them why. We asked some of those questions this morning. Melissa did. Why do you come to church instead of going to brunch? Personally, I don't feel like paying $12 for avocados on a piece of toast. That's why I don't get brunch. There are a number of reasons that we come to church, but they seem foolish to the outside. Why do you read a book that's 2,000 years old? Don't you know they've been publishing since then? Yeah, but we still feel like reading it, don't we? Why do you bother with the hypocrites? Isn't church full of a bunch of people who talk a big game and don't ever do anything with it? Yeah. Full of other kind of people too. How can you believe in a world like ours, where we understand so much, where we have a developed sense of physics and what is possible in this world, why would you believe in such foolishness as a resurrection from the dead? Why? Paul told them why. And he told them the right way. In the late 1800s, there was a man by the name of Hudson Taylor who was converted to Christianity in his young adulthood, and he committed almost immediately to being a missionary in the new mission field of China. And so after training and everything, he went. He traveled to China, and initially, he was a great failure. He went around these preaching tours, and no one really cared for him. They didn't trust him. They thought that he was trying to huckster them into something, and he largely failed, even though he tried on several occasions to get through to them. And I'm sure preached with all of the conviction and all of the right words and all that sort of thing, but it didn't go. But the reason why we remember Hudson Taylor is because he was a huge success. He changed his approach. And at a time where this didn't happen, he learned the native languages of China, the dialects, and how to speak Chinese. He adopted their dress. Matter of fact, he wore the garment of the day, and he even grew a ponytail in the back and shaved the front part of his forehead because that was the style of the day for men. And so he did so. He ate their food. He learned their culture and customs, and he became ingrained in their lifestyle. And so after 50 years of being a missionary in China, he is credited with making 18,000 converts to Christianity and starting over 300 mission centers in all 18 provinces of China. Why? Because, and this is what the theologians call it, of contextualization. He became those which he sought to reach. He became like them. He learned their language. He learned their customs. He adopted their practices so that they could literally hear the gospel spoken in a language that they could understand. Nowadays, that is common practice. Then it was revolutionary. No one had ever done it before. And now we've all learned from Hudson Taylor and we say, that is the way that you behave as a missionary. That is how it is done. It's contextualization. You were given credit because you listen to people and you care about them. And you took the time to learn their language and speak in a way that they could understand. And that's what Paul does in Athens. In the marketplace, he's haggling, because that's what you do in a marketplace. You barter and you go back and forth and you try to get the best deal that you can. In the synagogues, he's quoting scriptures and he's asking questions and probing them, because that's what you do in the synagogue. With the Stoics and Epicureans, he debated them because they were debaters, like Socrates before them. So he did that. And on Mars Hill, you bring something new. So he told them something they had never heard before. That unknown God, I want to tell you about him. They had never heard anything like that before. And make no mistake, church, when we walk out those doors in just a moment, we're entering a mission field. This is the place that God has sent us to be his missionaries, to be his emissaries in this world. We'll go to restaurants in a few minutes here. We'll go to marketplaces pretty soon. We'll go to work on Monday. We'll go to doctor's offices and appointments. And everywhere we go in Oak Ridge, we're going to encounter people. Geographically, we live in the South, but culturally, it's a melting pot, isn't it? People come from everywhere, and people, this place is open to new ideas, new ways, new thoughts, new cultures and theologies. We're like Athens. So how will we tell them the good news in a language that they can understand? I'm proposing to you that we need to learn how to do that. We need to learn the language of our community again. We need to learn their customs and the way that they dress and their culture and what music they're listening to, and just be a part of the life together that's going on in our community. And when we get that sense, then we'll be able to speak again. Churches all across the United States stop doing that for a while. We said to ourselves, we have a culture here. And so when people come in, they can learn our culture. They can learn our vocabulary. And then we can give them the gospel. And Paul is saying that's backwards. You are sent out to learn their way of speaking so that you might win them to the gospel. What did Paul say? I have become all things to all people so that some might be convinced of the gospel of Jesus Christ. When I was in Atlanta, there was one couple that we actually got to know. And it was, the husband was the barista at the coffee shop that I was always in. So I was friendly to the guy behind the counter, and we struck up a friendship. We're about the same age. And his wife was an accountant in the community, and so the four of us started hanging out. And we had done this for months, and we began to build a rapport with one another and understand one another and shared a sense of humor and culture together. And somewhere along the way, towards the end of our time there, the relationship fell apart. And they were splitting up. And he was leaving. And so when I heard about it, I said, I got to go to the coffee shop. I got to talk to him. So sure enough, he's behind the counter. I said, I heard what happened. I'm going to wait here at the table. Let's talk. And so when he could, he came over and we started talking. I had no clue what to say. What do you say to someone who's just done? And they're leaving town, quitting on their marriage. Couldn't prepare for something like that. So I just talked, honestly. I shared about my history with my parents being separated. I shared from myself, and he was open and honest with me about what he was feeling, what he was going through. And we had a chance to minister to his wife as well, who was left behind. 10 years later, we all still check in every now and again. They did separate. But we were given enough credit to be people that they still listened to because we spent life with them. We heard from these wonderful mentors here about what that is like, about the ministry of going out and learning someone else's culture. Those kids listen to them now because they are known, because they spent an hour every week to go out of their way and spend time with someone. And they brought games. Why? Because it got through to them. Because that's the language that they speak. They were able to read with them and do homework with them and pour their lives into them because they were speaking a language that they could understand. Melissa skipped around this sanctuary with children. Why? Because those little bodies need to move. She was speaking in a language that they can understand. So church, we are called to be like Paul. If you need a place to start building your words, ask me for a list afterward. I'll give you one. But I think what Peter means is this. When he says, be ready to give an account for the hope that's in you, I don't think it's a 7-point plan. I think he means learn the language. Build trust. Build relationships so that when the time comes, you're ready to speak. Because you've been listening for so long, you now know how to reach them. Will we be regarded as fools? Maybe. Probably. But the gospel continues because of fools like us.